Thank you so much for tuning in to Let's Talk, the official podcast of the National Runaway Safe Line, or NRS. At NRS, we operate the federally designated national communication system for youth who have run away, are experiencing homelessness, or who may be considering leaving home. For over 50 years, we've provided crisis support and resources for young people, families, and communities across the nation. On today's episode, I am joined by the incredible Natalie White, who's a licensed professional counselor hailing from the great state of Mississippi. Oh, here I go, stealing the intro again. Natalie, why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself for us?
My pronouns are she and her, and I have been employed here at Salicate Rental Family Services since 2014. I volunteered here when I was a teenager in high school, so kind of some roots here when I moved back to this area. So,
for the people who aren't familiar with the organization Salicate Winters Family Services, what are the first things that they should know about the organizations, like your programs and services?
Salicate Winter Family Services, actually, we are in our 33rd year of service. So originally it started off just as the emergency shelter program. That was the only program that Salicate Winters actually had at the time. And that program actually serviced youth that are from birth to age 17 that are in child protective services. And at that time, basically those services were strictly for children that are in state custody that also needed placement, whether awaiting foster homes or being adopted or acute or residential facility. So that's traditionally what everyone kind of thought or known Salicate Winters to be predominantly that type of program. And years later, we started the transitional living program and the basic center living program. And our last program that we actually have here on site is the Child Advocacy Center. So actually, Salicate Winters have four different programs that are for children and families.
Amazing. So going on 10 years, first of all, that's amazing. Congratulations. What was it like? Were there any like major shifts that happened at the organization throughout COVID or afterwards?
Yeah, well, interestingly, yes, I think, of course, we were affected just like the whole world was affected with COVID and having to adjust on how to continue to provide services. And one of the biggest things for us, unlike so many others, we never stopped servicing our youth. We continued to provide the services. We had to be very creative. We did not close our doors. It was still 24-hour, 7 days a week care. There were no virtual, there were no home visits, there were no ceasing of services at all. So that was very challenging for us as a staff, seeing all the rest of the world kind of stop. And the community kind of stopped because we had to, but we did not stop and continue the services and making sure we were adhering to all of the precautionary things when COVID hit. And then we got another hit. We actually had our executive director after 30 years leave. So that was a big, big challenge for us. And we're still kind of feeling a little bit of the turbulence, but we're doing well. We're doing well.
How do you feel about, like, how would you describe the state of Salicate Winters now? Are you excited for more progress, or do you think you guys have hit a point where you're like operating at full capacity?
I'm always optimistic. I think that we are not. I always tell the team that I work with, we are rural Mississippi, but I don't ever want us to think small. We want to think big and large like other states. And I just commend the staff and also the local universities that we partner with so we can continue to always stay ready to stay on the newest information and newest best practices so we can make sure we are serving the population. So I think that we are going to get bigger.
Yeah, I love that.
So I don't want us to close our eyes to that at all.
Yeah, one of the at the National Safe Place Network conference in Louisville this year, one of the things that one of the award recipients talked about people in this line of work is that it's like actually a calling. It's not easy, and it's not. I don't think it should be ignored the fact that most nonprofit organizations are often like facing challenges like that because the nature of the business that we do, we don't have income coming in like that. We really rely on our community. Correct. So I appreciate, you know, being able to recognize that there's always more space to grow and that the community should always be keeping their eye on doing things bigger and better. Can you explain what someone in the role of a clinical program director does?
Yes. Basically, I come from a mental health background. So basically what a clinical director does, really pay a lot of attention to how we are servicing the individuals. And I say individuals because no one is the same. We want to make sure we are welcoming all individuals and making sure we're taking care of their well-being. And we also, from my perspective, I always come with the lens of being trauma-focused to understand that youth, especially in this environment, our youth have been exposed to some trauma or experienced some trauma. So we want to make sure that we are taking care of every aspect of that individual. And that's kind of really clinically what I kind of look at. Also making sure that youth are understanding the importance of their mental well-being, their physical well-being, and emotionally. And I say that very candidly because with our youth, I say our, you know, with our youth, but because I want to be able to change the stigma of mental health and the issue. And so what our youth, and we're so proud of our youth that will sit down and have conversations about the struggles that they're having. And so clinically, that's what we do here. And what I do is to provide a safe space for them to be able to have those different discussions or about their trauma and still be able to have a great self-sufficient life. And it's possible. And that's one thing that we do for all of the programs. We making sure that we're addressing the trauma and making sure we are addressing the individual youth on whatever their needs are, whatever their requests are. And we do our best to try to meet them where they are, as opposed to trying to think we know what's best for them.
Yes, you're saying a lot of things that I love hearing, because I, when I talk to people at organizations like Sally Kate Winters, I always hear about being trauma-informed and how important it is when dealing with young people. I don't come from the nonprofit world or the runaway homeless youth community. I don't have any lived experience of my own. So the podcast is really like selfishly my own journey to learn about how to be a better member of my community and how people can get involved and try to make a difference. So I feel like a lot of people say that, like, oh, I want to be able to make change, or I want to do good. But it's really hard when you're living a life and life is lifing, if you know what I mean, to like spend any extra time like doing good for other people. I want to take the opportunity, because you're a clinical professional, to ask a question that I think will resonate with a lot of people, because again, I don't always understand. When with a shelter, is there a difference between like a what we're saying is like an emergency shelter and just a shelter, or like a women's shelter or a children's shelter? Or are all shelters just really considered emergency shelters?
That's a good question. It really kind of depends on the demographics. So with ours, it was it's emergency shelter based on the fact that we never close, open 24 hours a day, and the certain age gap. Certain age range that we actually serve. And that's for, of course, the children and protective services. However, of course, with our BCP program, that's the same kind of language we use when it comes down to those individuals. Because a lot of times the community sometimes is kind of misinformed about that, thinking that the youth that run away can only run away between 8 and 5, because that's the time administrative staff is here. You know what I mean?
Right.
But we make sure we educate to say, no, it does not matter if there is a runaway, that we are open to doors to those actual youth. They can come to the doorstep and we're here and we're ready to receive them. So yeah, it is a little bit different as far as even with adult shelters, it looks a lot different.
Okay. Thank you for answering that. I was thinking about how, like, so far I've interviewed a bunch of our youth advisory board members who are all youth with lived experience with being homeless or having run away from home. One of the things that they all shared in common is that they, like, really liked school. So yeah. I, when I think about like us also, like we're a 24-hour organization, but our office is open from basically from like 9 to 5 yeah. people are there. So for other organizations that are not 24 hours, I'm like, do you often get a lot of young people? I mean, I imagine, is that like a busier or a time where young people are more likely to actually come to the location?
Like during the 8 to 5 or just in the middle of the night?
During, like after hours, after I would hours. Say like during the evening or early in the morning.
Well, typically we get a lot of calls, but we do normally get them during the day. And the reason why mm-hmm. I say that, because we have several safe place sites that mm. youth will go to first. And so when they go mm-hmm. to that safe place site first, we'll make contact and do all of the typical protocol. And 9 times out of 10, we can get them bring them to our emergency shelter before close of day.
Gotcha.
And so even if something, we have had a couple of cases where youth will come in the middle of the night. But again, when they come in the middle of the night, they will come to the front door.
Gotcha.
Literally to the front door. And I love it. I love it. Because they feel just that safe to come to the front door, because we educate so much about our Runaway Homeless Youth programs, where they are very well informed, even if adults are not. Mm. The children are.
Yes. And it just seems like this generation of kids is a little more wise to those type of things.
Yes.
You talk about education, and that brings me back to, you were talking about like stigma and kind of erasing stigma. And I think that's another a thing that's overlooked when you're talking about trauma and generational trauma, is helping eliminate some stigmas, especially mm-hmm. like in the Black community and the queer community and the runaway homeless youth community. What are some of the stigmas that you see young people today challenging more than, say, when you were that age?
I would definitely say that the young adults, the stigma with dysfunctional families. I think when I growing up, of course, you kind of knew it, you kind of saw it, or it was kind of quiet. You don't say anything about this particular family that's having that particular issue. That's something that has changed. The older population, I would say, or more wise population, I would say, still are quieting about that. But a lot of the young adults that we're getting in, they understand what dysfunction looks like. And they do not want to be a part of that. They understand what trauma looks like. And they know that this is not normal, or this is very unusual, and I'm being affected. And so that's a difference that I've actually been seeing with some of the population that comes to us. Like, they get it. Like, it's not that they don't know. They get, like, this is unhealthy, and I need help. I need to get away. And versus mine, it's like, okay, well, you know it. Yes, it's a problem, but you may not want to say nothing yet, or you may just want to wait it out. That's kind of a lot of the things that I've been kind of seeing. It's like the kids now are more vocal, more aware, and they understand this is not healthy at all, and I need more support.
Do you ever have the opportunity to also have communication with or work with the parents or guardians?
Yes, I do. Going back to kind of changing the stigma of just certain things that, you know, maybe we once saw, not seeing anymore. We get to see a lot of the parents based on the youth. A lot of the youth, especially our younger youth, it seems like they're the voice of the family. And they the voice of the family mm-hmm. and needing the help. And instead of the parents or the adults in the situation getting the help that they need, is more of the child getting the help that they need. And then the parents like, oh, we do have that problem. Oh, this is an issue. Oh, I did abuse my kid, you know, so it's that kind of what we're seeing. When we get parents, it is a tug of war. I definitely would say we still struggle with parents and families, because the child or the young adult is getting healthy. Let's just say, for instance, our transitioning living program are doing so well, and then they get to a point, let's just say in therapy, hey, I want to reach out to my mom that wasn't the best mom. Wow. And of course, we're going to meet them where they are. If that's what you want, okay. But we're going to safeguard you as well. We're going to put some things in place to kind of, just in case this doesn't go over so well.
Yeah.
And that's what they do. But of course, what happens when there's so much strain and the young adult has gotten healthy or beginning to get healthy and have a self, really great self-sufficiency, the parent sabotages it.
Mm.
And not because it's a bad parent, it's just because the parent has not healed from their own issues. And they're trying to bring back some of the upbringing or some of the things that they have been exposed to the young adult that's now thriving. Mm. And that's kind of what we see, which is crushing every time we see it.
Yeah.
We're still there. We're still there, and they try, and we are still there to help support that young adult through it all.
It's so interesting. I'm actually planning another episode with someone else who was in our same session about the role that parents play when they have young people who have left home or things like that. And because I think that's a huge misconception, is that like it's really all just the young person acting out.
Mm-mm.
When I started at National Runaway Safe Line, one of the things that was being said a lot in our communication materials, because I work in communications, so like a lot of the old materials like referenced runaways aren't bad kids. And I was like, well, yeah, like everyone's situation is different. But like,
right. The
deeper context behind that is that there's so much more context. There's so much that we don't know or we don't understand because we're not there. And when I talk to kids I shouldn't say kids because they're all young adults. When I talk to people that have lived experience, they say like, no one knows what young people need more than young people. And it's because they're living in the situation. And like you said, they have a completely different perspective. I don't know if it's like what's in the media or the cartoons they grew up watching, like being more about like loving yourself and being nice to people. I don't know what it is that is so drastically different, but they are coming with a fresh perspective. And maybe it's because of being more connected through social media that people are just having the opportunity to learn more.
Now, I do agree with that. I think it's they have been exposed a lot more than we have, and they are more aware of different things in life. And I think the adults haven't kind of done a really great job of catching up to address or discuss or just be open when you have a young adult or have a kid that is struggling with particular things. And back to kind of what you were kind of talking about, I have to remind myself that the young adult is the best, like you are the best person to tell me
about
you.
And to advocate for yourself.
I can't tell you about you. You have to tell me, and I have to work with you with what you're giving me. And I think sometimes we have to, you know, like I said in therapy, like I have to tell myself that all the time, like, Natalie, I know you want to say this. I know you want to do this, but you know, you have to allow the young adult to go through the process. And I'm gonna be honest with you, some of the process is very painful.
I can imagine. I said as if I knew, as if I had this wisdom about it, but I say that because I know that I can't even fathom like what that experience is like.
Because you have to watch, you really have to watch them go through the process. You literally have to watch. And even if I feel like, oh my gosh, you want to have a connection with your mother, and your mother, and I know the past, I know the trauma, I know the background, I'm like, this is not gonna go over well. And we have to allow them to go through that, right? Because that in itself, I'm always afraid for re-traumatizing, but at the same time, no, it's not, because guess what was different that youth have now that they didn't have before? And it's us. We're their support. We're there when they fall. We're here when something doesn't work out. They didn't have that before. We've kind of pushed them to the limit of making sure they know kind of what to take and what not to take, so to speak, when it comes down to trying to open up issues that they have with their family members, because that's part of it. We have to do that as adults. When we're dealing with our own family members. So why should I walk around trying to protect this youth as opposed to trying to prepare the youth?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Are there any other misconceptions that you find coming from, I wouldn't necessarily say the parents, because I think that sometimes deep down the parents know, about community members that like for people outside of the runaway homeless community that may have a perspective or a lack of perspective on this, like what are some other misconceptions, or maybe just one in particular, that you think if people really understood, it would make a difference?
I would definitely say, and I'll say this, maybe you can help me with the wording. I think the misconception of that, you know, of course, the big thing is mental illness. Yes, we've done, I think as a world, as a community, we've done a great job of trying to change that stigma, but you have a lot of individuals still just do not believe in mental illness. Mm-hmm. They just don't. That's one. And then I would definitely say there is, and as far as our community, probably just rural communities, that there is not a such thing as youth being homeless. Mm. Adults, yes. But we have had, and still doing that, have to do outreach where we have to educate the community. Yes, it is a such thing as young adults being homeless.
It's a legal thing. Or I mean, yes. It's like a legal definition. Yeah.
Yes. And, you know, the first thing we get is, well, where are their parents? Yeah, I was just like, well, that's part of the problem, you know? Mm-hmm. Again, here, I would definitely say we're seeing such an influx of young Black males between the ages of 16 and 20. That is a very, and I'm trying to do a little bit more with that because we've gotten a lot more males in with our transitional living program, trying to change the stigmas of Black males not having issues.
Mm. Wow.
I love that topic because it's not talked about. That's why I love it. That suck it up, deal with it, whatever the issue is. You're supposed to be able to handle it. And that we have gotten a lot of our transitional living program males that I just adore that is really coming out and speaking and addressing issues. And I think that, again, that's the stigma as well as there's not a problem, deal with it. With that population.
I love that. Because that's, of course, as a Black man, that's like something I faced for sure. Mm-hmm. Do you also find that people, the age of young people who are like seeking your services on their own is skewing younger?
Actually, we've always had the younger population. What we have seen since COVID is 20-21-year-olds.
Oh.
That's where ours has actually shifted. Yes. For whatever reason, we're still trying to figure it out, but we typically get 17, 18, 19 year olds. But now in our transitional living program, it's been 20 and 21.
Is there any, well, you said you guys are still trying to figure that out. You know, it's interesting because I think mostly because we are a hotline and digital services like online where we communicate through chat and email and things like that, that it's a little easier for young people to access us. They just have to call. They just have to, you know, be somewhere private where they can chat or whatever. Mm-hmm. So we noticed during COVID that there was a huge influx of younger people as young as like 8 years old reaching out, asking about like mental health, asking about I saw this on TikTok and I didn't realize that this was abuse and I am actively in the same situation. So I've always asked that question, like, have you noticed in your services, is it just people getting younger? But that's interesting to know that, that it actually in some places is going to not, like, it's going to look different everywhere, you know?
And now that I think about it, for some of the referrals that we've got in, and I think it's because there has been, when COVID, of course, we are surrounded in our community, we are surrounded by three major universities. And I think, well, I know particular with two or three of the ones that I'm thinking about in my mind, they lost housing. That's one. Lost housing because for whatever reason, I guess they had a job, the job went away, you know, just all those different things were happening with COVID. And then, of course, living on your own, not having mom or dad or whoever around, and then you try to go back home and you had a different way of living mm-hmm. and was unaccepted, and you were told you had to get out. That is from some of the experiences that I can think back on that I know definitely for three of them that I'm thinking about. But I think that could be a possibility because we are, you know, close to the universities and things kind of changed and kind of shut down just a little bit before. And then two of them actually lost housing because they lost their jobs. And it was just a lot of, I think, just the transition of that, not having adequate housing at the time because of their finances. Not that they didn't have it, they had it, and then their finances mm-hmm. changed, and then that kind of put them in a situation where they were more at risk than anything. Mm. Yeah.
I usually follow up that question about like that people getting younger with like how, for the educational component, how do you educate someone who is younger about the same subjects, whether it's like sex education mm-hmm. or like safety or human trafficking, that things like that. How do you address those topics with older people or people who are like older than 18, I would say? Or do you find that you they're seeking the educational component less?
With the older, I would definitely say that they are probably seeking the education less, but then when they realize, oh, I do have issues with finances, or I do have, again, you have to let them go through it, you know, and my first question is, what brings you here? And then some of them be like, well, I'm homeless, I know that, but I want you to be able to tell me what is your situation? I don't want to just assume. Mm-hmm. So a lot of times when you're putting them in the driver's seat to be able to say what the issue really is, because some of them that are older, they will definitely say, well, I just need to get a job and I'll be fine. No, it's more than that, right? And we know it's more than that, but I want you to be able to see that it's more than that. So it's like, I think we have to wait to provide that education piece for them once they are able to vocalize, oh, Miss Natalie, that is an issue. Okay, now it's time for the education piece because you're ready. Because early on, they're like in this, what we call like pre-contemplation. They're not, mm-hmm. They just want quick fix.
They can only see the surface level
issues. Exactly. And once they start saying like, wow, now we can get you to the contemplation stage and really being like, I need to make some changes here. You're not trying to just fix it. You want me to have a life. You want me to thrive. You don't want, you know, me to get back out here on my own and not thrive.
Yeah, you made me think of something. And this was a real perspective check and a privilege check for me as I was talking to one of the young, I was actually talking to our youth fellow. Her name is Sharde. She did an episode, a couple of episodes back, and she said that, you know, she felt like she did well in school and she liked school, but she felt like there were some other developmental things that she was behind of at the age of like 18, 19, 20, 21, 22 years old. And when I think about it, I'm like, I think that we assume that like people just know these things, but they don't. Like, I wasn't taught anything about financial education in school. I had the things that you're talking about, the like these young people experiencing. I'm 33 years old. I have, like, as I've gotten to my 30s, I've seen my friends go through that at like 30 years old. So yes. I just feel like the world is actually forcing these young people to reckon with those things, these harsh realities that in the world, realistically, you have to take care of yourself and you can't just constantly rely on people. And for these young people, that ability to be able to rely on someone else has been yanked away from them in a lot of cases. Right. So they're being forced to reckon with this a lot earlier in their life. They're actually more advanced than people my age who haven't had to struggle because they've learned to take care of themselves truly, or they've learned the importance of like getting, because like I'm very fortunate that my family has always been able to provide for me and give me everything that I want or everything that I need, even if it wasn't everything that I want. Right. Like, I'd still had access to everything that I could ever need. You know what I mean? So it's like,
right, exactly.
But what didn't come with that was financial education. Like, my parents weren't able to teach me about finances because they weren't taught about finances. It's not that they don't know how to save money or how to be frugal or whatever. It's about like really understanding how it all works, how the credit system works, and how all of the systems like rent, being able to sign a lease or being able to buy a car, how all of those things are stacked against you when you don't truly understand what's going to happen when you sign a contract or things like that. When you just think it's about being able to spend the money you have, that's a lack of real education, in my opinion.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what we have. Exactly what you're talking about with our transitional living program. We actually have every Thursdays life skill classes.
Are there other things that you find young people ask for, or like when they're given the autonomy, things that they immediately are like, this would be really helpful?
What we do is we do once a month. We kind of just kind of allow them, once they get to a point where they're comfortable, either provide us with some topics they would like education on, or they teach a topic. And what we do, we're the audience. We're part of the group. The adults are part of the group. So they're teaching me, even if I feel like I know I'm an expert at sex education, right? So you're teaching me on something that I thought that I knew. So we try to make sure we do that, you know, so they can understand that it's a learning curve for all of us. And it's so fun because we just had, I had just had this experience yesterday. Last week we had a youth that talked on boundaries because he was having issues with that because of his, of course, trauma he experienced within his family. And so he moved into this, of course, transitional living houses with other males, and his boundaries were very, very poor. And so he taught a life skill on it. And it was something that I did. And he was like, last week, he was like, because now he said, you know, now he said, I think you just really kind of violated my boundaries, but I don't think you realized you did. I was like, okay, well, good. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for pointing that out. Yeah. You know, so, our relationship just grew just then.
Exactly. So I was just like, he's like, so you're not offended? I said, no, I'm not offended. That's because I'm going to tell you when you violate mine. But yeah, we kind of leave it open for them to kind of let us know on what, of course, we have a curriculum that we kind of use, but we try to make sure we let them know, hey, we're not going to stick to this topic if this topic is not what you need to be addressed. Mm-hmm. We also talk to them about, because they always say, well, why do we need to know something about cars when we don't have a car? I said, well, you may be riding with someone, you know, and the car breaks down. So we have individuals coming and teaching them about that, how to purchase a car, how to secure your, which is a big thing right now, how to secure your social security number and how to not get hacked. And so even when they're getting their job and they're like, well, I don't have credit, and who got a credit card? And they end up finding out that like maybe their relatives or a family member that have gotten their social security number. And we talk to them about credit. We actually have had several youth where we've had to get credit repair, and they haven't even really established credit of their own. So just those type of things. And when they realize, oh my gosh, what's out here and what I have to learn. Because again, we have to look at it. If you're homeless, you're working on trying to survive every day.
Yeah, absolutely.
You're not,
and then
you're
when something comes up, like, oh, you go to open a bank account and they are asking, like, oh my gosh, as somebody who's had serious, I can't remember what I was doing, but I was just answering security questions. It wasn't even like a loan. And they like pull up your, I might've been like trying to switch my phone service, and they ask you a couple of questions about your credit history. And it's like, who is the lender for your boat loan?
Yeah.
And
I was like, you're like, what?
What? And it turns out somebody had just been using my social security to go wild in like Florida or something. I don't even like hear about it, but sorry, I don't want to trail off topic.
No, but that's exactly it. And then the question thing is when you find out for our youth, sometimes it's their family.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like majority of the time is their family. Mm-hmm. And it's like, then you have to go and do some repairing on that, mental repairing on that, and then turn around and kind of, help you to fix your credit. So it's like a double whammy that they're having to kind of deal with there. So, but yeah, credit is a big thing. Social media is a big thing. Sex education is a big topic that we kind of talk about a lot. In our area for Mississippi, we've been talking a lot about human trafficking. So we've actually had several cases that the youth that we have right now are familiar with because it's been on the news. And so we've been talking about that a little bit, and them really not realizing how prevalent kind of it's becoming in this area. So we have done a lot of education around that. We really have. And I would definitely say knowing how to establish your own family has been a big topic of discussion when you have had family that has not been as supportive or a good network. So we've been doing, they have asked a lot about that. Like, how do I make my good friends, the positive friends, the connections that we have formed into this family? And we've been seeing a lot of requests on kind of how to do that, how to make that make sense for them. And that's a new thing that's kind of been going on that I think is really impressive with our young adults.
That's so cool. I love that. I mean, we've done many episodes specifically about chosen families. Yes. Usually, I think maybe that's a stigma that I should work on fighting myself, is that that's not just something for the queer community. It's something for everyone.
Like, oh, yeah. Chosen family
is extending so far beyond that.
Yes, definitely.
I have one more question for you, although yep. I do feel like this could go on forever. If there was one piece of information that you think if you could make known to everyone to really make a difference, what do you think that would be?
Ooh, gosh, it's hard. One thing that the community should know to make a difference. I hope, or I would like for our community to choose to be educated on how to serve the at-risk population. And when I say serve, meaning to be a part of, not to come and just give and put a band-aid on it, but really serve and be a part of the at-risk population.
I couldn't have said it better myself. And if you're in Mississippi listening to this right now, I encourage you to visit sallykatewinters.org and learn how you can support this amazing organization in your community. They have a volunteer button right at the top right-hand side of their page. And if you click that, there are several ways that individuals and organizations can show their support. And that's the same no matter where you live. For many organizations, your time is as valuable or more valuable than your money. But also give, you know? Links to everything you need are available in the description of this episode. Thank you all again for tuning into Let's Talk, and I'll talk to you soon.